From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The fighting continues at its present intensity. If there's no halt in that, if there's no political progress made, then we could indeed be facing a very serious situation indeed. I think already this is one of the biggest movement of population, displacement of population we've seen this year.
A humanitarian crisis looms in Somalia. Over 350 people have been killed in the past 10 days. The UN says more people have been displaced in Somalia in the past 3 months than anywhere else in the world. Then a look at immigration.
These immigration raids are being used to blackmail us into accepting the president's immigration reform program, which is basically guest workers and more raids and more enforcements. The reality is if all people without documents went home tomorrow, whole industries in the U.S. would collapse and some of the biggest corporations in the world would go bankrupt.
We'll speak with labor journalist David Bacon, and we'll be joined by a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers that recently waged a successful campaign against McDonald's over the price paid for tomatoes picked in Florida. Now they're taking on Burger King. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate has voted to provide nearly $100 billion for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, while setting a non-binding timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. The vote came one day after the bill passed in the House. The final vote was 51-46. Senators Gordon Smith of Oregon and Chuck Hagel of Nebraska were the lone Republicans to vote with Democrats. Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman joined Republicans opposing the bill. White House spokesperson Dana Perino promised an immediate veto.
I just spoke to the president in the Oval Office, and as he said he would for weeks, the president will veto this legislation, and he looks forward to working with congressional leaders to craft a bill that he can sign.
In news from Iraq, at least 72 people died in violence around the country Thursday. 27 bullet-ridden bodies were found on the streets of Baghdad. Another 8 people were killed, 19 wounded in a bombing near Baghdad University. The violence comes as the top U.S. commander in Iraq is warning U.S. and Iraqi casualties are likely to rise as the military struggles to carry out its goals. General David Petraeus spoke Thursday in Washington.
The situation in Iraq is, in sum, exceedingly complex and very tough. Success will take continued commitment, perseverance, and sacrifice, all to make possible an opportunity for the all-important Iraqi political actions that are the key to long-term solutions to Iraq's many problems. Because we are operating in new areas and challenging elements in those areas, this effort may get harder before it gets easier.
Meanwhile, an active-duty Army officer has come out with a scathing critique of how top U.S. generals are handling the war in Iraq. Writing for the Armed Forces Journal, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Yingling writes, military leaders have understated the strength of the Iraqi insurgency to the American public. He writes, quote, for reasons that are not yet clear, America's General Officer Corps underestimated the strength of the enemy, overestimated the capabilities of Iraq's government and security forces, and failed to provide Congress with an accurate assessment of security conditions in Iraq. Yingling continues, our generals are not worthy of their soldiers. In other Iraq news, a senior U.S. Army officer overseeing a prison in Baghdad has been charged with aiding the enemy. Lieutenant Colonel William Steele is accused of several offenses, including allowing prisoners to use a cell phone and having a relationship with a prisoner's daughter. Former CIA Director George Tenet has accused the Bush administration of blindly leading the country into war in Iraq and then using him as a scapegoat when their pre-war claims prove false. In a new book released next week, Tenet writes, quote, there was never a serious debate that I know of within the administration about the imminence of the Iraqi threat. He adds, there was also never any discussion of containing Iraq without a full-scale invasion. Tenet also takes issue with administration officials' repeated citing of his infamous slam dunk remark about evidence Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Tenet says he was referring to the ease of making a public case for war, not the specific issue of WMDs. Tenet was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom Award in December 2004, 6 months after he resigned in the fallout over the administration's pre-war intelligence. In election news, the eight leading candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination held their first debate Thursday in South Carolina. Former North Carolina Senator John Edwards opened with criticism of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's refusal to join him in apologizing for voting to authorize the Iraq War.
And I've said many times that if I knew then what I now know, I would not have voted that way. But I think the real question before us is, what do we do now? How do we try to persuade or require this president to change course?
That was Hillary Rodham Clinton. We're now going to turn to former Senator John Edwards.
Senator Clinton and anyone else who voted for this war has to search themselves and decide whether they believe they voted the right way. If so, they can support their vote. If they believe they didn't, I think it's important to be straightforward and honest, because I think one of the things we desperately need in our next president is someone who can restore the trust bond between the American people and the president of the United States, because I think that trust has been devastated.
Meanwhile, Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich explained why he's the only candidate to support the impeachment of Vice President Dick Cheney.
This country was taken into war based on lies about weapons of mass destruction and al-Qaeda's role with respect to Iraq, which there wasn't one at the time we went in. I want to state that Mr. Cheney must be held accountable. He is already ginning up a cause for war against Iran. Now, we have to stand for this Constitution. We have to protect and defend this Constitution. And this vice president has violated this Constitution.
And former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel challenged what he called the military-industrial complex.
We spend more as a nation on defense than all the rest of the world put together. Who are we afraid of? Who are you afraid of? But, Brian, I'm not. And Iraq has never been a threat to us. We invaded them. I mean, it is unbelievable. The military-industrial complex not only controls our government lock, stock, and barrel, but they control our culture.
In Somalia, clashes between U.S.-backed Ethiopian forces and fighters aligned with the Islamic Courts Union in the capital, Mogadishu, are being described as some of the heaviest fighting in the city's history. Local human rights workers report at least 329 people have been killed over the past 10 days. Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning more people have been displaced in Somalia in the past 3 months than anywhere else in the world. This is the U.N. Relief Coordinator, John Holmes.
We could indeed be facing a very serious situation indeed. I think already this is one of the biggest movement of population, displacement of population we've seen this year in terms of numbers, and particularly in terms of comparative numbers compared to the populations of Mogadishu and indeed of Somalia as a whole, greater in that sense than Darfur, Eastern Chad, and the problems there are serious enough.
We'll have more on Somalia after headlines. Tensions are increasing over the Bush administration's plans to build a missile system in Eastern Europe. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced he is suspending Russia's obligations under the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. The Cold War Treaty caps the deployment of conventional arms inside the former Soviet Union and outside its old borders. Putin says he based his decision on a buildup of NATO military bases near Russia and U.S. plans to host missile facilities in Poland and the Czech Republic. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has signaled she'll reject a House subpoena to testify on her knowledge of the Bush administration's use of pre-war intelligence to lead the country into the Iraq War. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee wants to look into the administration's false claim Iraq tried to purchase uranium from Niger. Rice spoke Thursday in Oslo.
If there are questions he has, I hope he will pose them, and I will be happy to answer them. But there is a constitutional principle. This all took place in my role as National Security Advisor, and there is a separation of powers, and advisors to the President are under that constitutional principle, not generally required to go and testify in Congress.
A family in California has filed a civil suit against U.S. officials for seizing a young boy and detaining him for more than 10 hours in a recent immigration raid. 7-year-old Kevin Reyes was asleep the night of March 6th when immigration officers burst into his bedroom. Kevin and his father, Noiris, were taken to a detention center in San Francisco. They were kept in a locked room, given only bread with mayonnaise and water. Reyes says he showed immigration officers the boy's U.S. passport, but was ignored. He was also denied permission to call a relative to pick up Kevin from detention. Reyes says his son has been withdrawn and had several nightmares since the raid. In Atlanta, two police officers have pleaded guilty in the shooting death of a 92-year-old African-American woman. The victim, Katherine Johnston, had fired on the officers after they had broken into her home. One of the officers has admitted they obtained a search warrant by lying about information from a police informant. Officers Greg Jr. and Jason Smith are expected to serve at least 10 years in prison. In Utah, hundreds of students gathered at Brigham Young University Thursday to protest a commencement address from Vice President Dick Cheney. More than 3,000 students, professors, and alumni at the Mormon school had signed a petition to oppose Cheney's visit. Here in New York, activists with the group ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, confronted the basketball legend Irvin Magic Johnson last night over his endorsement of the pharmaceutical company Abbott Laboratories. Earlier this year, the company announced it would withhold 7 new drugs from sale in Thailand, including a new AIDS drug and treatments for arthritis and high blood pressure. The unprecedented move was called in retaliation for Thailand's plan to import or produce cheaper generic copies of Abbott's AIDS drug, Keletra. According to an ACT UP press release, activists confronted Johnson with banners reading, "Abbott's greed kills people with AIDS in Thailand." ACT UP says Johnson voiced support for their demands and said he was raising the issue with Abbott executives. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for our coverage on Abbott and the Thai controversy on Thursday's broadcast. And finally, in Washington, 14 people were arrested in the Senate office building Thursday for unfurling 2 30-foot banners calling for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. One banner read, quote, "Your silence, your legacy," while the other listed articles of impeachment. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Somalia, fierce fighting has killed over 320 people over the past 10 days. This comes just 3 weeks after another series of battles claimed at least 1,000 lives. Agence France-Presse described Thursday's clashes in Mogadishu as some of the heaviest fighting in the city's history. The fighting began in December when U.S.-backed Ethiopian forces invaded Somalia. 4 months ago today, Islamic fighters abandoned the capital, marking the official fall of the Council of Islamic Courts, which had controlled Mogadishu for 6 months last year. A humanitarian catastrophe now looms over Somalia. The United Nations says more people have been displaced in Somalia in the past 3 months than anywhere else in the world. Some 350,000 people have fled fighting in Mogadishu since February, more than a third of its population. That makes the rate of displacement in Somalia over the past 3 months worse than Iraq. Many of those displaced are camped on the outskirts of Mogadishu and lack food, medicine, and clean water. There's also concern for those trapped inside the capital, where more than 600 people have died from acute diarrhea and cholera. This is the UN Relief Coordinator, John Holmes.
There are stocks available in the area. If we can sort out the access problems, if we can step up our presence, if we could achieve a ceasefire in Mogadishu and the surrounding area, then I think we will be able to cope with the problem with some difficulty. But if the fighting continues at its present intensity, if there's no halt in that, if there's no political progress made, then we could indeed be facing a very serious situation indeed. I think already this is one of the biggest movement of population, displacement of population we've seen this year in terms of numbers, and particularly in terms of comparative numbers compared to the populations of Mogadishu and indeed of Somalia as a whole, greater in that sense than in Darfur, Eastern Chad, and the problems there are serious enough.
Prime Minister Ali Mohamed Gedi said Thursday his forces were now in control of Mogadishu. The BBC reports for the first time in 9 days gunfire has stopped. Ethiopians and government troops are patrolling the city, conducting house-to-house searches as residents collect rotting bodies that have been abandoned in the streets. The escalating war in Somalia has received little attention in the U.S. media, especially on broadcast television. Using the Lexis database, Democracy Now! Examined ABC, NBC, and CBS's coverage of Somalia in the evening newscasts over the past 3 months. The result may surprise you. ABC and NBC has not mentioned the war at all. CBS mentioned the war once in a Sunday night news broadcast. The network dedicated a total of 3 sentences to the story. Salim Lone is a columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya and a former spokesperson for the UN mission in Iraq. He joins us today from London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Salim.
Thank you for covering Somalia, Amy. As you said, the coverage is absolutely shameless.
Well, first, Salim, can you describe who the fighting forces are and who's behind them?
Well, I mean, the key country there is Ethiopia. Their occupation forces have been there, in fact, long before the actual war began. They came in around September, October. But at the moment, those fighting the Ethiopians and the nominal transitional federal government, which is really an absolute puppet, it's quite hapless. In fact, the Ethiopians don't even deal with Somalis that they're fighting through the transitional government. They go directly to the elders of the clans to try to negotiate ceasefires. But those fighting them are obviously the Hawiye clan fighters who dominate Mogadishu. I mean, historically, they're the largest clan in there. But there are also many others, not just Islamists, which is a code word for terrorists, but there are many Somalis. In fact, most Somalis will not abide this occupation. I mean, this is what is most distressing about this fighting. All fighting is terrible, but you hope in the end something good comes out of it. But in this particular case, it is clear Somalis will not abide the Ethiopian occupation or the government they put in place there. So it is not going to be a successful war for the Somali government, for Ethiopia, and of course for the U.S., which is the orchestrator of the whole adventure this time.
Salim Lone, you're now in London. The British think tank Chatham House criticized the U.S. role in the war. The authors of the report write, quote, in an uncomfortably familiar pattern, genuine multilateral concern to support the reconstruction and rehabilitation of Somalia has been hijacked by unilateral actors, especially Ethiopia and the United States.
Well, you know, this is par for the course these days. What they should have also mentioned, but it's an excellent report, by the way. I really enjoyed reading it, and I'm so glad they were so candid. But one of the big issues here is not merely the unilateralism of the United States, but the inability of the international community, and particularly the United Nations Security Council, to try to play, if not an independent role, at least a moderating role. It is quite astonishing that for now 3 months, there has been terrible violence in Somalia. And yet, we have not heard anything from the Security Council about how this carnage must stop. There is no interest whatsoever. You know, the death toll, I mean, you've given all the details, so I don't want to go into it, but let me add that women are being raped, that hospitals are being bombed. This is clearly a huge effort to intimidate and terrorize all those who come from clans who are fighting the government. They want to intimidate the civilians because most of the death toll is of civilians. So this has been going on, and there has been no call whatsoever for this to stop. You had Sir John Holmes there. He's a Brit who I don't know him personally, so I cannot speak for him. But clearly, he has been appointed, in fact, by the British to his crucial position as Chief of Humanitarian Affairs. So we are seeing the Security Council completely silent while these atrocities are going on. We have seen Western governments completely silent. Nothing has come out of Washington. Nothing has come out of London. We now see, for the first time on Wednesday, the ambassador of Germany, and Germany holds the EU presidency now, the ambassador released a letter which he had sent to Abdullahi Yusuf, the president of the transitional government. It is a very candid and a very strong letter, and that's wonderful. However, where was Germany? Where was the EU for all this period? Their silence has really given the green light for the Ethiopians to do the terrible things they've been doing. The death toll now in Somalia is greater than it was in Lebanon. And you will recall, of course, that even then, the big powers, the U.S., U.K., even initially the U.N., did not demand a ceasefire. But the world media was full of that story, and there were condemnations around the world for what the Israelis were doing. But, of course, Somalis and Africans don't count nearly as much, because there has just been no international outcry at all. It's not just the media.
Salim Lone, we're going to break.
So we really have a problem there.
We're going to break and come back to this discussion. We'll also play a comment or interaction in the State Department on what is happening right now in Somalia. Salim Lone, columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya, joining us from Britain. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, that traditional Somali music. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Salim Lone. He is the former spokesperson for the UN mission in Iraq. He's a columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya and is joining us right now from London. Salim, I wanted to talk to you about the U.S. role in all of this. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met with the Ethiopian foreign minister on April 23rd. At a news conference the next day, State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick said the two had discussed the presence of Ethiopian troops in Somalia. McCormick said the troops had, quote, no desire to stay there any longer than they are needed, but that they didn't want a withdrawal to, quote, open up in Somalia. A reporter questioned him about his comments. This is an excerpt.
Concern you at all that your opening statements, with the exception of some, mm-hmm. with the proper names, mm-hmm. could have applied exactly to the situation in Iraq right now. Does that concern you at all?
I'm not sure I see your point, Matt.
That the Ethiopians say that they don't want to stay there any longer than they're needed, mm-hmm. but they don't want to leave a vacuum. It just sounds an awful lot like they're taking a page from the administration's thoughts on what to do. But I guess so my question is, are you concerned that we might be seeing the beginning or, the middle of it, an Iraq-style insurgency going on, maybe, obviously not directed at U.S. soldiers, but the same kind of thing. Are you concerned about that?
The situations are completely separate. They are, each are sui generis. But you are, in each case, concerned about leaving the field to a group of violent extremists who do not have an interest in building up the institutions of a democratic state. So in that sense, there are similarities. I think certainly the specifics of each situation are quite different, and the histories are quite different. And I think the level of intensity of fighting in Iraq is quite different than you're seeing in Somalia, and the scale of it is a lot smaller.
State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick, the reporter went on to ask him whether the United States is calling for a ceasefire.
Are you calling for a ceasefire in Somalia, or are you urging the Ethiopians to go for these insurgents with as much intensity as they could?
You don't want to see any more violence in Somalia. Everybody would like that to be the case. But there are clearly people there, individuals, who are intent upon using violence in order to further a so-called political cause. And we've seen that in other areas around the world. And what can't be allowed to happen is for those forces to gain a foothold, to develop a safe haven from which they could possibly launch attacks against other states in the region and further.
So you're not calling for a ceasefire? No.
We want to see an end to the violence, but the real way to get an end to the violence is A, stabilize the security situation, and B, find a political situation that is workable for the major political factions in Somali life that have an interest in actually building a different kind of Somalia as opposed to the one we've seen for the past two decades.
State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick. Salim Lone, columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya, your response.
Well, I mean, I'm very interested in the Iraq analogy, and it is really multiple. Apart from what was already said there, the contrasts are striking as well. But let me add on the analogy, actually, that May 1 is approaching. That was the day when, right after the war, President Bush said that his mission had been accomplished. We have the same statement coming out of the Prime Minister of Somalia yesterday, that the mission has been accomplished and the insurgents have been wiped out. But let's look at the other contrasts, which are very fascinating. In Iraq, the world body, the Security Council, for the first time in many years since the Soviet Union collapsed, stood up to the United States and refused, despite enormous pressure, to authorize a UN war in Iraq. In Somalia's case, it is precisely the opposite. To begin with, the lawlessness of this particular war is astounding. I mean, this is the most lawless war of our generation. You know, all aggressive wars are illegal. But in this particular one, there have been violations of the charter and gross violations of international human rights, but these are commonplace. But in addition, there have been very concrete violations by the United States to begin with of two Security Council resolutions. The first one was the arms embargo imposed on Somalia, which the United States has been routinely flaunting for many years now. But then the U.S. decided that that resolution was no longer useful, and they pushed through an appalling resolution in December, which basically gave the green light to Ethiopia to invade. They pushed through a resolution which said that the situation in Somalia was a threat to international peace and security at a time when every independent report indicated, and Chatham House's report on Wednesday also indicated, that the Islamic Courts Union had brought a high level of peace and stability that Somalia had not enjoyed in 16 years. So here was the UN Security Council going along with the American demand to pass a blatantly falsified UN resolution. And that resolution actually was a violation. It contravened the UN Charter. You know, the UN Charter is like the American Constitution. Legislators pass laws, but they have to be in conformity with the Constitution. In this particular case, the Charter is the UN's Constitution, and the Security Council is not allowed to really pass laws or rules that violate the Charter. And yet, who is going to correct them?
Salim Lone, on April 8th, the New York Times reported that the Bush administration recently allowed Ethiopia to complete a secret arms purchase from North Korea. in violation of international sanctions. The U.S. allowed the arms delivery to go through in January shortly after Ethiopia invaded Somalia. From North Korea, Salim.
Well, I mean, this just, you know, shows the lawlessness, the complete lack of pretense even to try to honor these resolutions. The big powers decide what resolutions are passed. But now what we see is the big powers then decide, are we actually going to honor the resolution that we just passed? I mean, I want to give you an incredible example of how the Security Council has become a plaything almost. There was a time when Security Council resolutions had gravitas. For example, everybody knew Resolution 242 asking Israel to vacate occupied territories in exchange for peace. But now it's a plaything, and I want to give the example of the bombings in Spain in the year 2004. Just before the Spanish election, there was this terrible atrocity, as you know, about 200 people, Spaniards, were killed in the terrorist attacks on the trains. Because it was on the eve of the election, the Aznar government, afraid that if it was known that this attack was by terrorists, might lose the election, got the U.S. to support a Security Council resolution which condemned the Basque separatists for the attack. And the Security Council went along with that. I mean, a day later, it became clear that was a total lie. So the Security Council resolutions really have no meaning now because they can be passed and violated at will, especially by the United States.
Salim Lone, the Dow Jones Newswires recently reported that the U.S.-backed Somalian prime minister wants to pass a new oil law to encourage foreign oil companies to return to Somalia. Royal Dutch Shell, ConocoPhillips, Chevron Corporation once had exploration contracts in Somalia, but the companies left the country in 1991. How significant is this in the U.S. involvement in Somalia today?
Well, you know, as you've discussed before, Somalia itself and the region, the Horn of Africa, is newly oil-rich. Kenya also has some oil. Oil is the key to domination for the United States, global domination, I mean. But it is going about, you know, the wrong way to get that oil. The U.S. is also worried that its welcome in the Middle East is diminishing, and they need to make sure both they want to encircle the Middle East with the oil field, and they want to make sure they have Somalia and other countries handy for the oil. But this, you know, the Prime Minister's attempt to lure Western oil companies is on a par with his crying wolf about Al-Qaeda at every turn. Every time you interview a Somali official, the first thing you hear is Al-Qaeda and terrorists. They're using that. No one believes it. No one believes it at all, because all independent reports say the contrary. But they're using that to try to develop support. And, you know, this is why it is so important. Europe has now been coming into the forefront with its concern. It had this report about major human rights violations had occurred a month ago in Mogadishu, and the Europeans were afraid that they might be complicit in those because they were supporting the warring the groups that were committing those atrocities. Germany, as I said, released that letter on Wednesday. Even the American ambassador has written to Abdullahi Yusuf, the president. I mean, they are really writing letters to the Somali president. They will not raise this issue in the Security Council. They will not raise this issue in Washington or London. They want to keep this as a small African issue. And it is so important for all of us to put pressure on the governments in Europe in particular, and on Africa, too. I mean, Africa is weak. It cannot really take strong stands. In my own country, Kenya, we have played a terrible role in these extraordinary renditions in Guantanamo Bay that are going on. But, of course, one leading opposition candidate in Kenya said that the U.S. has promised to support the government in the elections at the end of this year in exchange for the terrible things it has been doing.
Salim,
so Africa is weak.
I want to ask you quickly, as you talk about Guantanamo, the secret prison in Ethiopia. Not clear how many people are being held there, if this is one of the black sites, one of the prisons that are not very well known about in the world that the U.S. is involved with. But we do know that Amir Mohamed Meshal is there. He is a New Jersey young man from Tinton Falls. Jonathan Landay of the McClatchy newspapers reported April 24th, Ethiopia has changed its mind and decided for the time being not to free the American Muslim who was captured trying to flee war-torn Somalia and was held without charge in Kenya and Ethiopia for more than 4 months. Can you talk about this secret prison?
Well, you know, there are... Did you say secret prison?
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is this whole enterprise, the kidnappings on Kenyan streets, the grabbing refugees who are coming across the border, has a, you know, made in America stamp on it, because you've seen it all happen before. And these secret prisons, the U.S. denies any responsibility in this whole operation, and yet we know that CIA and FBI officials are in those prisons interviewing the inmates. We also know, by the way, that many of the people who have disappeared are not in those secret prisons. Where are those people? Have they been killed? Are they being tortured somewhere else? This is, you know, utter lawlessness, and we must try to get the Europeans in particular. I keep appealing to the Europeans because I know, I speak to many European ambassadors in Kenya, I know that they are privately very concerned about what is going on, and we must get them to do more. It is fine to indicate there are war crimes being committed. It's fine to say this must stop and hospitals shouldn't be bombed and you can't keep relief away from suffering people. But they must go beyond that. They must take an initiative. Or talk privately to the United States and say, look, this is a lost cause. We are only creating suffering and we're creating problems for ourselves, because there will be blowback on this. There will be animosities and angers which will affect Europe, America, Africa, everywhere.
Finally,
so they must take a lead.
Finally, Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General's call for a coalition of the willing to go into Somalia, your former UN official.
You know, it is so disgraceful for him to try to get the Security Council, that's what he proposed, the Security Council, in case there is no peace in Somalia, and they're meeting in June, in mid-June, to discuss it in the Security Council, for him to propose that the UN should now go in to do what the U.S. and Ethiopia have been unable to do, which is basically to impose a client regime on Somalia. It's just absolutely disgraceful. I mean, I read that report to the Security Council, and it is hard to believe that Mr. Ban Ki-moon is the Secretary General of the United Nations. It is so blatantly and comprehensively one-sided. There is not a word about the fact that the Ethiopians are there without any international legitimacy. They're occupiers. They violated the UN Charter. They were not in any danger of being attacked, and they invaded. So this notion must also, this notion that a coalition of the willing must be formed. As you know, that was how the first Gulf War was fought. And if this coalition comes into place, which I hope will not, it will merely internationalize the crisis and make things even worse. But I hope the Europeans in particular and the Africans who are on the Security Council will not allow that to happen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Salim Lone, columnist for the Daily Nation in Kenya, former spokesperson for the UN mission in Iraq when it was bombed there, attacked there several years ago, now living in Kenya, speaking to us, though, from London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we turn now to what's happening in this country. Over the past month, U.S. authorities have arrested and detained at least 750 immigrants in raids across the country. The sweeps are part of a program dubbed Operation Return to Sender, run by the federal agency ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In California, 359 immigrants were detained over a two-week period in late March and early April. Many of the arrests were made after officials from ICE raided private homes. In Maryland, 65 workers were detained in late March during a raid at the sportswear company Under Armour outside Baltimore. On April 4th, in Beardstown, Illinois, ICE raided a slaughterhouse owned by Cargill. 62 workers were arrested. Here in New York, 42 immigrants were arrested near Albany in early April. Authorities raided private apartments and picked people off the streets. Two immigrants were arrested while buying a pizza. In Pennsylvania, 61 immigrants were arrested during a four-day sweep. In Wilmer, Minnesota, immigration officials were accused of waging a campaign of terror and intimidation after they raided private homes without warrants looking for undocumented immigrants. 49 arrests were made. Immigrant rights advocates sued federal authorities and accused them of targeting anyone who looked Latino. On April 17th, 19 workers were arrested during a raid at a potato farm and processing plant in Colorado. 2 days later, in West Burlington, Iowa, 17 more immigrants were arrested at a concrete plant. Another 88 immigrants have been detained recently in New Orleans. Longtime labor journalist and photographer David Bacon joins us now in our Firehouse studio. He's been closely following the recent immigration raids, has just written the article, The Real Political Purpose of the ICE Raids. David's a programmer on Pacifica Radio's KPFA in Berkeley and author of the new book, Communities Without Borders, Images and Voices from the World of Migration, in New York this weekend for the Labor Voices Conference. What is the purpose of these ICE raids in your eyes, David?
Well, Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of Homeland Security, told us what the purpose was, Amy, when he said after the raids at the Swift meatpacking plants last fall that these raids were intended to show Congress the need to adopt the Bush administration's immigration program, which is essentially huge new guest worker programs and an increase in enforcement both in the border and in workplaces. So essentially, I think communities and unions and progressive people around the country were being, this is a form of extortion, really. It's like saying to us, give us what we want, or here's what you can expect to have more of. And it's a very, I think, an inhuman and a brutal way of forcing us to agree to this program, because the people who are paying the price of this are people like the young child that was held in San Francisco in the detention center for hours and hours and hours. I mean, these are just ordinary human beings who are just trying to work for a living.
We're going to go to break, then come back to this discussion. David Bacon, labor journalist, will also be joined from a member of the Immokalee workers, who's just won a major battle against McDonald's next, taking on Burger King. Stay with us. Vyacheslav Rostropovich, he died in Moscow today at the age of 80, well known for his championing of human rights and his harboring of the Nobel writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Again, Vyacheslav Rostropovich died in Moscow today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by David Bacon, labor journalist, writes for a number of publications, including The Nation, The Progressive, the Pacifica News Service, as well as the Pacific News Service. His recent piece, The Real Political Purpose of the ICE Raids. David, the recent arrest of people in the New Bedford factory in Massachusetts, describe what happened.
Well, ICE came in and it took people off the line. They came in, as usual, with warrants saying that there were certain people who had deportation orders, or that they actually had the names of some people on warrants. But, of course, what they do is they have the names of a few people on warrants, and then they pull in a whole lot of other people who are around them. There were a lot of women who work in this plant, so they took the women and they shipped them to detention centers in places like Georgia, for instance, long ways away from Massachusetts. They were separated from their children. These were women who were responsible for picking up their kids after school. So there was a big outcry because of the separation of families here. And I think it highlights one of the important reform provisions that are being made in Congress now, which is the Child Citizen Protection Act, where often the children who are being separated from their mothers are citizens themselves, people who were born here, and yet they're either being deported themselves because they have to stay with their parents, or they are separated from their mothers and their fathers, and we need to make sure that families are kept together.
I mean, it's an amazing story. The women who were taken from the New Bedford factory, I mean, their kids, some infants, some women breastfeeding, taken away, and their kids are just left with someone who was taking care of them while their mothers were at work.
That's right. This is a very kind of, again, this is a very inhuman policy, this kind of these kinds of immigration raids, and it's obvious that ICE really has no respect for people's families and is really looking at people in a very anti-people, anti-human way.
How does it work? How does a raid work, whether it's in a private home or whether it's in one of these factories?
Well, again, you know, this is a supposedly Operation Return to Sender, so ICE has the names of a few people on warrants. So they'll go, for instance, in Richmond, California, they went out to a school and stationed themselves in front of the school, supposedly looking for these people, and just stopped everybody coming in and out, asked people for their documents, but only, of course, people who look Latino. And in this case, they were stopping women who had just dropped their children off. So obviously, they were going to separate these families if they picked up any of the people who were involved. Or there was just another immigration raid in Chicago where they went to a parking lot in a kind of a mall in the Latino community in Chicago and began, they just sort of closed off the parking lot, people carrying, you know, assault rifles, they looked like soldiers. And they, again, had the names of supposedly four people that they were looking for. How they expected to find them in a shopping mall, in a parking lot, I have no idea. But what they really did was they went and asked everybody for their immigration papers and began just sort of pulling people in, shoving them into vans.
Can you talk about the Republican Senator John Cornyn proposing to eliminate all family-based visas and allowing people to come into the U.S. only as a result of recruitment by corporate employers?
Well, yes, this is the Bush proposal. Bush really wants to do, and the corporations want to do away with the system of family reunification, which is the system under which people get visas, permanent residence visas, to come to the United States to reunite their families. And so Bush and Cornyn are proposing to instead, as part of setting up these huge guest worker programs, to only allow people to come to the United States when they're being offered a job or when they're being recruited by a big corporation. So really they're trying to transform our immigration system into one in which people's only value in the United States is as workers for some large corporation rather than as people with families and communities. You know, it was an achievement, Amy, of our civil rights movement in 1965 when people like Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and Ernesto Galarza and Burke Corona convinced Congress to end the Bracero program, which was a contract labor program, and instead initiate a new kind of immigration system whose intention was to protect families and communities. And this is what the Bush administration is trying to do away with. And at the same time, you have to remember also in Congress right now are things like new fast-track authority for negotiating new trade agreements. On January 1st of next year, the agricultural chapter of NAFTA will go into effect, which will allow big U.S. grain companies to dump corn and beans on the Mexican market, which will displace tens of thousands of more people who will have no alternative but to enter this migrant stream. So on the one hand, the administration is doing those things which cause people to have to migrate, you know, increasing economic desperation, and at the same time trying to kind of convert that stream of migration into a stream of workers. And only workers, in other words, not families, not communities, just people whose only value is what they can do for a corporation.
On Monday, I went down to Raymondville, Texas, to this vast tent detention camp right behind a prison. As soon as we got there, we were met by the security, and they cocked their guns at us, one of the men in the pickup truck saying, "We got to get off the property now." We reported on the Jonathan Hutto facility, where kids are held, hundreds of kids. The ACLU is suing now, and talked to a 9-year-old boy named Kevin who said, "I just want to go home. I just want to be free." What about these prisons?
Well, the Bush administration is privatizing the enforcement of immigration law. They're building huge detention facilities which are run by private corporations, like Halliburton, for instance. Halliburton has started to build these. And this is part of the increased enforcement program that the Bush administration has. This is sort of like the flip side of the guest worker programs, is to try and negotiate or to establish new guest worker programs to bring people to the U.S. as contract workers, and for anybody who's not part of that program to begin to arrest people, detain people, as we're seeing in these raids, put them into these kinds of, I would say they're close to concentration camps, really, but that are also sort of private business giveaways to Bush cronies.
Where is Halliburton building them?
There are contracts that the administration has put out now for the construction of detention centers. This is part of the proposal for the wall. So on the one hand, you build the wall, and on the other hand, you build detention centers along the border. And so there are contracts now that have been let out for the building of these detention centers, and Halliburton has gotten some of these contracts.
To the Dubai-based company?
The Dubai, yes, right. No longer a U.S.-based company belonging to our vice president, or one where he used to be an executive of it, for sure.
Well, as we talk about immigration and labor, I also want to bring into this conversation Gerardo Reyes Chavez. He's a farm worker and member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. The coalition represents over 4,000 mostly immigrant workers who labor in the agricultural fields of Southwest Florida. The group recently waged a successful campaign against fast food giant McDonald's over the price paid for tomatoes picked in Florida. In 2005, the Immokalee workers also won a campaign against Taco Bell. Gerardo Reyes Chavez, welcome to Democracy Now! You're both here for this Labor Voices conference. Talk about this victory that you just won. You were on your way to McDonald's headquarters?
Mm-hmm. That's right. This is another big step for us in our struggle for fair food that started basically with the boycott of Taco Bell in 2001. And for us, this victory represents a big step because, in one hand, we have the agreement with Taco Bell and John Brands. The agreement was signed with the parent company of Taco Bell. And John Brands is the largest corporation of fast food in the world because it's made by five brands, among them Pizza Hut and Kentucky Fried Chicken. Now we have this agreement with McDonald's. And what it represents is that we have the two biggest restaurant chains in the world with us, saying that they agree to pay more so that the farm workers have an increase of 32 cents per packet of tomatoes that before that was stagnant since 1978 until now.
Explain how it works, because I remember certainly with the struggle with Taco Bell, they were saying, we have no control over what these tomato pickers are getting paid because we're not the ones who pay them, it's subcontractors. The same thing with McDonald's. How did it work? Did you meet with them at the beginning and they refused? And then how did the pressure build?
It was a process that took 2 years to McDonald's. And after the victory with Taco Bell, after the agreement with them, we started to try to bring them to the table. And they were just trying to find another ways to find a solution, but without necessarily including us on that process. And we knew it was not going to work. And after 2 years, they realized that it was not working. So they had to sit at the table. It was because of the pressure of the people. There were many students all over the country organizing in solidarity with us. There were churches in the institutional level putting pressure publicly.
And how did they put pressure?
They were just sending strong messages, for example, the NCC, the National Council of Churches, sent a message to them. People like John Sweeney from the AFL-CIO, students making protests, people from churches taking the streets. And
how many tomato pickers are they? Are there?
There are, I would say, around 6,000, maybe a little bit more. Every year is a little bit different.
And where are they originally from?
Our community is formed by workers from Mexico, Guatemala, and Haiti, mostly, and a few of other countries.
And who is next in your sights?
Next in the list is Burger King, because they have said publicly that they are not going to, they are not willing to do anything to improve the lives of the farm workers, who in this case make their profits possible.
How much do tomato pickers get paid?
It's 40 cents per packet of 32 pounds, which is what it means. You have to pick 2 tons in a day in order to make only $50. That it's not enough to have a decent living. And sometimes it's not even enough to pay rent, and sometimes it is impossible to pick the tons. That is without any type of benefits or protections that exist in other industries. So we are just struggling in order to establish things that are normal. The most basic human rights are non-existent when you are a farm worker.
David Bacon, we're moving up on May Day, on May 1st, the anniversary of big protests. What are the plans for May 1st? Where do you see the immigrant rights movement today?
Well, I think there are going to be demonstrations in communities all around the country. You know, that's what we saw last May Day, was not just the huge demonstrations in Los Angeles and New York, but also that they were taking place in communities where we're not even accustomed to thinking of immigrants constituting a large part of the people there. So I'm going to be in New Jersey and Pennsylvania in little farm worker towns, you know, marching with some of the workers there. So I think that a lot of people are going to come out on May Day because the problems that we were trying to deal with a year ago are still there. We need a legalization program in this country for the people who don't have papers, and a real one, not some kind of phony temporary status, but one that really gives people rights and permanent residence. And at the same time, I think that people have sort of upped the ante since last year. We need to look at the fast track authority. We need to look at the implementation of this last chapter of NAFTA and stop those from happening, because we also need to try and stop those things that are forcing people into this migrant stream so that people can choose for themselves whether to come
or
not.
Now that the Democrats are in charge, do you see them doing anything different than the Republicans?
I think there's a debate in the Democratic Party between people who are basically want this corporate program and are willing to make a deal with corporations to get it, and other people like, you know, for instance, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee in Houston, who proposed last time a real legalization program that would give people green cards, and she connected it with a jobs and employment program, which I thought was a very far-sighted kind of proposal here, and she, I think, is still advocating for that.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. David Bacon, labor journalist, Gerardo Reyes-Chavez of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, for being with us today. And we'll continue, of course, to follow this issue. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Becca Staley, Rebecca Silver, Kieran Krugmeadows, Julian O'Connor, Jerome Bourgeois, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chambly. On Saturday at 4 o'clock, I'll be in Los Angeles at the L.A. Times Festival of Books, 4 o'clock at UCLA. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for more details, as well as for transcripts of today's broadcast and the video and audio podcast. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org is our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.